Welcome to the Physiological Reviews podcast. Today, we will discuss an editorial titled Systematic Reviews for Basic Scientists, A Different Beast, that is published in the January 2023 issue of the journal. Joining us are Editor-in-Chief Dr. Sadis Matalon and author Dr. John Ioannidis. Dr. Matalon, over to you.
It is a great pleasure to be together with Dr. John Ioannidis, whose name is synonymous with success in science and, of course, systematic reviews. When I became the editor-in-chief of Physiological Reviews, I promised the committee that I will initiate a program to include systematic reviews as part of our dossier. At that time, everybody wanted to know what exactly is systematic reviews. Well, I am delighted to welcome Dr. Ioannidis, who wrote a great editorial on the importance of systematic reviews in basic science. Let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Ioannidis. And again, I will only hit a few highlights because we can spend the entire podcast talking about his many successes. He is professor of medicine, of epidemiology and population health, and by courtesy of statistics and biomedical data science at Stanford Medicine. Dr. Ioannidis is one of the six best-cited physician scientists in the world, with an amazing age factor of 235. One of his articles in PLOS Medicine on why most published research findings are false is the most accessed article in the history of public library with over 3 million hits. He has received a large number of highly prestigious awards, including at least two honorary degrees. He is an elected member of numerous national academies, including the US National Academy of Medicine. Honestly, I could not believe my luck when he accepted the offer to become an associate editor of Physiological Reviews. John, you are an example to all of us of what a successful scientist could be. Could you tell us a little bit about your background and how did you get started in the type of research you are doing?
Dear Sadis, thank you for the very kind invitation to join you for this podcast and also for the invitation to join you in Physiological Reviews, which is an amazing journal that has made major contributions to our understanding of physiology and related issues. I have to say that my career has been very bumpy with lots of surprises and lots of quests. I think that since I remember myself, I was very much interested in science based on curiosity, but also in terms of saving lives, in terms of improving people's lives. And this is why, even though my main love was mathematics, I decided to go into medicine. I tried my hands in different types of investigation early on, including basic science bench work, as well as epidemiology, biostatistics, and clinical research. The common denominator that I was seeing in all of these themes and fields and subfields was that science is very difficult to do correctly. Each one of us might be doing our best, but it's very easy to make mistakes. It's very easy to have error being introduced. And what attracted me the most was the validity of the methods that we use and how we can optimize the methods and how we can optimize the evidence eventually, how we can get the big picture to be as accurate. And if not immediately as accurate, how it can be corrected over time as we accumulate more evidence. And I think that then it was just a matter of meeting lots of wonderful people who were very smart and very knowledgeable, and from whom I try to learn. I still try to learn from thousands of people who I interact with, and I think I know less than anyone who I interact with.
Well, you are very humble, John. You contribute greatly, and everybody's glad to interact with you. John, let's talk a little bit about the article you published in PLOS Medicine. The title of the article is "A Lot of Science is Wrong," but I think it's perhaps not fair to say it's wrong. It cannot be reproduced. Could you tell us what contributes to this uncertainty in science? So what contributes to non-reproducibility, and what can we do better?
I think that the odds of getting things right immediately are not very high in most scientific fields. And it's very easy to get them wrong when we do the first analysis. In some fields, there's just too many questions that can be asked, and too few of them might be leading to interesting signals. I think it's also important to realize that there's biases, that some of them we may be aware of, but many others we are not. And there's also potentially superimposed conflicts of interest. Many studies that we do are pretty small, and this means that one study in isolation is very likely to get things wrong, either false negatives or false positives, even if there's just a tiny amount of bias. So the composite picture is that the odds are not very good when we start, but science is a wonderful iterative process. So when we accumulate a lot of evidence and we try to get rid of these biases, eventually, hopefully, we should get things right.
John, this is great. And you brought a lot of points that I would like to expand on. When I looked at articles published, for example, in the New England Journal of Medicine, they would insist on multiple centers being involved, on very large number of patients, and so on. However, when we publish articles in basic biomedical research, quite often you will find ends of 6, 8, if you like it, 10. Therefore, some of the statistics we do make assumptions about normality and so on that may not be true. So how do we get around, do you think, John, the small number of samples? And do you think that they contribute to non-reproducibility?
Small sample size does contribute to non-reproducibility, unfortunately, because it's very difficult to make sure that the signals that are important will be discovered in small studies. And as I mentioned, even with a tiny amount of bias in a small study, it's very easy to get a false positive result. Now, if there's other errors and conflicts superimposed, that would make things even worse. This doesn't mean that we should abandon small studies, but we should find ways to make them more transparent, to make them non-selectively available. So it could be that multiple scientists are performing small studies on the same or similar questions. If we only make available just some of them that fit to one narrative, obviously we will get a very biased picture. But if we make all of those available and we're able to put them together, ideally with a preemptive plan rather than just searching for them after the fact, after they have disappeared, the odds are better that we may get closer to what might be the true estimates. Also, I think that we need to think ahead of time whether all of these very tiny small studies are justified, or whether some teamwork, team effort, some multi-center collaboration, some consortium might be the way forward. And perhaps multiple scientists working on very similar questions instead of each one of them trying to perform a very small study in their lab. It could be that they could join forces to perform something that is more integrated and cumulatively has more weight. It is also more cross-checked across all these scientists who can discuss about the optimal methods, the optimal ways to avoid bias, the optimal design, the optimal way to combine their data in a plan that is set ahead of time, rather than just try to unearth who did what after the fact.
This is a wealth of information, John, that will be very, very useful to our readers. And I would like to expand on a couple of points. First of all, what is very important to me as the editor of Physiological Reviews is that our reviews are totally unbiased. And I have been trained to think that reviewers and associate editors make sure that reviews are unbiased. And in many cases, we do get comments to the effect that we should include this and that paper. Unfortunately, we all humans, and reviewers and editors have their own bias. My wife, Dr. Leanne Rittenberg, who has written many systematic reviews, introduced me to the idea of a systematic review and as the gold standard for an unbiased review. You are the master. Can you tell us what exactly is a systematic review and how can it help us remove bias when we're dealing with a basic science topic?
A systematic review is an effort to put together the evidence, the existing studies or ongoing and future studies in a given topic in a way that follows some rigorous systematic search with rigorous eligibility criteria, with pre-specification of what the sources of the data would be, with pre-specification of what the process will be for extracting information, combining information, appraising critically the rigor and quality of the information, and performing, when feasible, some synthesis of the evidence. The synthesis ideally should be quantitative, in which case we have a meta-analysis, but sometimes the only thing that we can realize is that the data are so different, so heterogeneous, and or so biased that perhaps that quantitative synthesis is not achievable. Does systematic review eliminate bias? It maps bias. It gives us a better, a more objective perception of what might be the different biases and errors and problems that may exist in the body of evidence for the research question that we are trying to tackle. It does not eliminate bias. It tells us where bias is and how big it might be, and therefore what kind of influence it may have on the results. It does help to decrease, if not eliminate, bias in the process of selection. So if I have a very strong belief because of some conflict, it doesn't have to be financial. It could be that I'm just conflicted because I want to prove a theory that I proposed and I built my career based on this. This is what I grew up scientifically in. I may select just the studies that are supportive of my theory. So a systematic review places some safeguard that not only these studies will be included, but also other studies that may not be congruent with that particular narrative. And therefore, one would be able to see the totality of the evidence. If studies are excluded, one would see why they were excluded, what were the reasons, and then could be able to tell, are the reasons justified, or is it a biased process of exclusion? So systematic review is systematic. It doesn't mean that it is not biased, but it gives us a much better footing to deal with bias most of the time.
John, tell me then, do you think that systematic reviews have a place in basic research, or are they mainly should be used for clinical science?
I think that they definitely have a place in basic research, and perhaps they have an even more desirable place in basic research rather than clinical science. Clinical science has many other factors that make the conduct of a relatively unbiased systematic review more difficult. For example, the conflicts of interest, particular financial conflicts, are much stronger compared to basic science, where most basic sciences, I don't think that they have any strong financial conflicts in attacking some blue sky type of questions that nobody knows what will come out of them. So I think that they have a very nice opportunity to contribute and to offer systematic information, systematically distilled information on questions where almost always the evidence is highly fragmented into multiple small studies that may not be exactly the same, but they may be similar and they may paint a very, very confusing picture otherwise, unless someone could put them together and put them in some order, in some systematic assessment and critically appraise what they tell us, what the numbers look like, what we know and what we don't know.
John, one of the problems with a systematic review is that it takes a while to write, and it requires a team of people to come together, including a master librarian. And I have seen Dr. Risenberg and going through thousands of articles, abstracting them to decide which one should be included and which one should not be included. In your outstanding editorial, you mentioned something called a living review as an example of a systematic review. Can you tell us what a living review is? Is it something that's continuously updated? And how can one go about writing such a review?
So for some research topics, practically one can put together the evidence from the studies that exist. And this is all that has been done. This is all that will ever be done. Maybe the systematic review and also the primary study suggests that the question is settled, that we don't need anything else to be added to this. The effects, the signals are very strong. And this is it. it's the end of history. In most interesting scientific fields, and I think that applies to most fields in basic science investigation, evidence can change very rapidly. We have new studies being added to the mix. We have new investigations that add more evidence. And we need to keep track of that new bolus of evidence that get infused now and then, sometimes at a very rapid pace in that particular field. So instead of thinking of a systematic review as a one-time shot that will be the end of time, we can think of systematic reviews as living systematic reviews, where one does put all that effort that you described, and sometimes it is a lot of effort, to get a first systematic review done. And then there's a plan for continuously, routinely updating that evidence as new studies, new data, new information appears and needs to be integrated. The pace of living systematic reviews can be very fast. There can be some automation that can help. There can be some streamlining that had helped. The process of setting the machinery in place allows one to do things much faster. We've seen that, for example, with COVID-19, which was a major crisis, and we had to move very fast. We had a number of teams performing some very nice living systematic reviews where the evidence could be incorporated in real time and get updates on what the signals look like, what the treatment effects look like, how strong is the evidence, what are the potential biases. Sometimes even 2 months could make a big difference. In some other fields, 2 decades might not make a difference. But increasingly, we will see scientific questions where 2 months might be making a difference. And clearly, most fields, 2 years would make a difference. So we need to be in a position to update the evidence synthesis, the systematic review, in appropriate real time.
I think this will be a dream come true for most editors because, yes, new papers come up all the time and may change the way we think about things. So I think that would be great. Now, so John, tell me, do you think that current review format is going to be eliminated and be replaced by systematic reviews? Are we going to have a hybrid system? What do you think the future holds?
In most scientific fields where systematic reviews were introduced, I think that they have become dominant in terms of claiming the credit and the prestige of credibility. At the same time, of course, we have realized that all reviews, including systematic reviews, can suffer from lots of biases and errors, much in the same way as you can be biased or have errors in a primary study, one can be biased and make errors in a systematic review. But I think that everywhere systematic reviews seem to become the dominant and most credible means of synthesizing evidence compared to the narrative reviews. Have narrative reviews disappeared? No, they continue to exist. And I think that we have seen a proliferation in the number of reviews along the growth of the scientific literature, both for systematic reviews and for narrative reviews. We do need the insights of experts. We need that extra sparkling idea that maybe only experts who have worked in the field may be able to come up with when they look at the evidence and try to think, what does this mean? And what could it mean for the next step, for the next wave of scientific investigation? So systematic reviews are not there to exterminate experts who write narrative reviews. They're there to complement experts, to help experts, to augment their ability to design the research questions and the research agenda for the future in a more productive, more unbiased, and more reproducible way. So my guess is that systematic reviews sooner or later will conquer, quote unquote, also fields of investigation, like several basic science fields where they're not as prominent yet. But the best scenario, if they coexist and mutually nurture evidence synthesis and seeking the best evidence along with the best scientists in the field. I think that they should be integrated in the process rather than seen as an invader who is taking over.
This is wonderful, John. Now, let me touch on another subject, John, which is very, very important for the future of science and the future of our young people. You mentioned the importance of groups collaborating together so the whole is much better than the parts. And this is extremely important. However, John, when you look at young people right now, there is a quest of independence. And young people, as you know, cannot wait to break off from their mentors and be on their own. And I think this is to the detriment of science. And this was actually mentioned by Dr. Ruddy and Dr. Mann in the previous podcast. But the problem is, if groups get together and you are fifth author among 30, somehow promotions and NIH study sections do not give you proper credit. How do you think we can overcome this, John? Because it is important for all of us to work together.
I think this is a major challenge, and obviously we need the right incentives for good teamwork to exist at the level of funding, at the level of promotions, at the level of recruiting early career investigators into faculty positions or research intensive positions. I have nothing against independence. Personally, I consider myself a very independent person, perhaps even extremely so. I also believe that teamwork is important. So independence and teamwork can coexist. In a way, teamwork, the ability to join forces with others, allows independent people to materialize their ideas in a much more efficient way compared to if they were just trying to do it alone. So the current paradigm where each investigator will try to get a little bit of money and collect a few samples and write papers all alone, siloed and solo, is not really very efficient. Most of the time, it doesn't work. Conversely, if there is an appreciation of teamwork, these ideas that a very smart independent investigator may have can be fueled to the larger team. And then you will have much better designed studies, much better powered studies, much better protected from bias studies that could be conducted with these ideas that young investigators could have. I think that promotion committees already realize that in many fields, they need to appreciate people's contributions beyond just the solo siloed work. And I think that some fields are more sensitized to this than others. Some institutions are more sensitized to this than others. We need to pay more attention to issues of quality, of reproducibility, of a sharing culture, replication, reproducibility culture, and reward those people who really use the best methods and use the best practices, the best research practices to do their work. Is it perfect out there? No. Is it difficult for young scientists? It's extremely difficult. I feel for them. We should try to help them and try to give them opportunities to be both independent and team players.
This is wonderful, John. And physiological reviews will work with you to bring better appreciation to the powers that be of the importance of team science, because this is how we get things done. And as Dr. Ruddy mentioned, this prevents your work from being lost in the noise of many, many small publications. So, John, again, you are one of the most successful scientists I know. What advice do you have to the young people starting right now? You hear complaints that this is too hard and cannot get a grant. Overall, it's difficult to start a lab. Why should people go to science? I mean, what advice do you have to get them excited and to make them pursue scientific careers?
I think that there's nothing more exciting that I can think of than working in science. Just the mere ability to meet extremely smart people and to learn from them, the ability to correct yourself all the time, to find new questions, new frontiers that are fascinating is very unique. So I think that science is the best that can happen to humans. And in terms of biomedical science, it's even better because it's not just curiosity. It's about eventually saving lives and helping people to live better lives. So I think that young scientists should not lose track of what a wonderful blessing science can be. And they should not lose their excitement and their enthusiasm, despite all the obstacles that are in the way. It's very unfortunate. We have very limited funding for science. We have even less funding for young investigators in most countries, including the US. You know, the average age for an investigator to get the first STARA 1 grant is astronomically high. It's very, very unfortunate. So I think it's up to us, to senior investigators, to make sure that we find ways to not dilute but enhance the enthusiasm of young scientists. And I think young scientists should just make sure that they don't give up on that enthusiasm. There's difficulties. Eventually, difficulties become part of the reason why you are in science. It's just being able to overcome difficulties and being able to find a way to continue being enthusiastic is something that is very important. I see very talented young people. I feel privileged to work with many of them on a daily basis. And I believe that one day they will prove me wrong in everything that I have published. This is my dream. So I think we should support them to keep trying that.
That's great advice, John. I remain excited about science and I plan to work till I die. It's, as you say, it's a privilege to be working with such highly intelligent people. And the small successes we have help us take us over the top because a lot of experiments don't work. A lot of grants and papers get turned down. But we need role models, and you are one of them. So thank you, John. Is there anything else you would like to contribute before we finish?
I think we covered a lot of ground, and thank you very much, Sadis, for organizing this. It was a great pleasure to talk with you, and I look forward to our next session.
Thank you, John. It is a great honor and a privilege to have a discussion with you, and thank you so much for being an associate editor for Physiological Reviews.
A million thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Physiological Reviews podcast. You can subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please rate and review the podcast wherever you listen to it. And be sure to share it with your friends and colleagues. Check out our other articles and find other podcast episodes on our website at prv.org.